For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org. Good morning.
Good morning.
And a special good morning to everyone who is joining us for the first time. And thanks to everyone who set their clocks back. My name is Aishan, and I am giving the talk today because Tygon is away, and we'll be back next week. And I really wanted to talk today about generosity. It's sort of a topic that feels like it starts to come up, you know, right after Halloween, and we start thinking about the holidays and, you know, Thanksgiving and all kinds of ways in which we, you know, are reminded, I guess, of a spirit of giving. And in Buddhism, generosity is a very important practice. It's known as dana paramita. And paramitas are, there are sort of 10 of them that we recognize. They're considered the transcendent practices of bodhisattvas. And a paramita really means to cross over to the other shore. So when we practice paramitas, we're actually helping ourselves and maybe also helping others to cross from, you know, sort of a constricted sort of feeling of suffering in our lives over to sort of the other metaphorical shore of awakening. And, you know, practicing the paramitas is one way to begin to reveal the sort of intrinsically enlightened quality of our hearts. When the idea, I think, is that we have this enlightened quality in everyone, but it's sometimes obscured. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the ways in which it gets obscured. But one way to reveal that enlightened quality is by practicing generosity and giving. And so dana goes back to, you know, the very earliest days of Buddhism when Buddha was living with just sort of a community of monks. You know, lay people would give to the monks. They would give alms or financial resources or food or sometimes shelter. And the monks would receive what was given gratefully and really try to accept what's given in life. There's a precept that we, you know, follow to this day of not taking what is not given. And I think, you know, in especially the earliest monastic times, the idea was that when you are practicing as a monk, you accept what life gives you, whether you like that, whether you don't, whether you feel grateful, and find a way to you know, to practice with that. So, you know, ideally, I think, you know, in practicing dana paramita, our giving should reflect, you know, sort of this boundless openness of heart, unconditional love, and to be, you know, completely free from attachment and expectation. And yet, you know, we are human beings, and we, I think, you know, have a lot of attachments and expectations, and sometimes just the very process of thinking about generosity or thinking about giving can really, you know, bring to light maybe some attachments or expectations that we were not aware of. There's a very famous story from, you know, sort of ancient Buddhist times about Emperor Wu of Liang, who was a great promoter of Buddhism in China. You know, he built temples and he supported monks and was, you know, very much wanted Buddhism to prosper. And he was visited actually by Bodhidharma, who was considered sort of the first patriarch of Buddhism, who brought Buddhism from India to China and was, you know, greatly revered. And I imagine that Emperor Wu was very much, you know, wow, I'm meeting Bodhidharma. And he showed him all the great temples he had built and the monastic communities he had supported. And he asked Bodhidharma, you know, how much merit have I gained by doing this? And Bodhidharma replied, none whatsoever, which I think was probably a little bit deflating to Emperor Wu. And, you know, he sort of asked perplexedly, well, you know, who are you to say such things? I mean, you didn't say things like that to an emperor, no matter who you were back then. And Bodhidharma's reply was, I don't know. And he turned and left. And there are a lot of different points to this story, but one of the points is that, you know, we give without expectations. I think Suzuki Roshi would talk about gaining thoughts or gaining mind, and we, you know, can have this expectation that we're going to get something, you know, when we give. And so one of the ideas in practicing Dhanaparamita is to give without expectations or give without attachment. But I think what I want to talk about today also is the idea of giving without separation or without a sense of separateness between ourselves and others. We think about ourselves as giving and others as receiving, or others as giving and ourselves as receiving. And yet I want to talk about a way that we can maybe consider approaching giving without so much separation. We acknowledge this when we are here for maybe an all-day sitting and we have lunch in the Zendo and we have the meal chant in which we say, you know, we realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And, you know, practically speaking, we can recognize sometimes that when we when we give, we do sometimes receive something, you know, whether that's a good feeling or, someone's appreciation. But that's actually a little bit different from what I mean. You know, there isn't really any giving without receiving, but I want to talk about it in a little bit of a different way. You know, we can kind of give with a sense of magnanimity or superiority. And even when we receive that feeling of like, oh, you know, I feel good, I gave something, you know, the receiver is still out there, and the receiver is maybe subtly we're thinking about the receiver as being a little bit inferior. They're not us. And similarly, you know, if we receive something from someone else, we can sometimes feel a little bit of a sense of shame or dependence or just a sense of being a little bit less than. You know, there's a way in which giving and receiving can, kind of imply a power dynamic. And I want to try to get away from that a little bit. I actually want to propose that giving can take place in sort of a continuous mutual dance between ourselves and our environment, which includes others. There's a, you know, resources of whether it's money or energy or food, they're continually flowing into our lives. And resources are also continuously emanating from us, whether that's money or skill or time. And I think that there's a way in which we can, think about this and work with this sort of dynamic shifting of resources in a way that helps us to let go a little bit of some of our attachments to things. I think our circumstances can sometimes make this hard to see. And I found a really interesting article recently in which, this wasn't the point of the article, but it was just sort of a random illustration. They talk about a woman who was in a business class seat on a plane, you know, closer to the front. She's got a little more leg room. And a man walks by her on his way to the coach section, sort of muttering, you know, how does it feel to be rich? And she describes having this reaction of just feeling ashamed, and she was suddenly caught up and sort of muttered back, you know, well, I didn't pay for this, my company paid for it. It was she had to explain it. And I love this story because, you know, on the one hand, sometimes we don't feel that we have very much, you know, like this guy walking on the way back to his coach seat. You know, maybe we feel like, I don't have enough to give. Somebody else has more. We think about other people maybe having more. And, you know, sometimes comparing ourselves to our perceptions of other people can lead to some envy and creates distractions for ourselves. So, on the one hand, this gentleman walking on the way to his coach seat, apparently was able to be in a coach seat on an airplane and yet was aware that somebody else seemed to have more in that moment and maybe led to some, I don't know what kind of feelings exactly. He could have felt superior, you know, he could have felt envious, I don't know. And yet we often have more than we think or more than we perceive. And I was doing a little research, just practical research while I was writing this talk, and I discovered that the median income of per capita income in the United States is a little over $39,000 a year, which according to this website that I found called the Global Rich List actually puts you in the roughly the top 3% of world income. They compare incomes, you know, kind of per capita incomes from statistics that are available worldwide, and they will tell you, you know, kind of exactly where you lie. And I found this really illuminating. I know I was going to ask people to, you know, just sort of call out random incomes and we could see where they lie. But we can do that. It doesn't have to be your own personal income. But I was thinking as I was getting ready for this that I know our presidential candidates have been talking about, you know, what defines the middle class. And I think we all sort of had maybe this reaction of like, what do you mean $250,000 is the upper limit of the middle class? That's insane. But what, does anybody remember what the lower limit of the middle class was? Did one of them say 50,000? Does that sound?
Sounds right.
Sounds, whether we think that's...
The lower limit of the middle class is 50,000? No, the lower limit of the middle class is probably like maybe 35,000.
Okay, but I think the candidates were sort of suggesting that maybe the lower limit of the middle class was 50,000, or no?
Actually, I thought the median income in the United States was around 46,000, actually.
The figures may have changed. The figures may have changed. Well, we could put in 46,000.
I just responded to your...
Yeah, sure.
I try to follow these things myself.
Well, I'm not always the most up-to-date, but why don't we put in 46,000 as the, you know, that's somewhere in line with what I think our presidential candidates have been suggesting is the lower limit of the middle class. Just to make this so that it's not anybody's sense of their own personal income. Okay, so if you are making $46,000 in the United States, you are in the top 1.43% richest people in the world. You know, and there's been so much, I think this is interesting because there's been so much focus on, you know, the 99% and the sense of solidarity that we can have from, you know, the 99% versus the 1%. But when we take a step back and think about globally, you know, most everyone in the country is living considerably better than most people in the rest of the world, and they give a statistic that says, you know, 3 billion people live on less than $2 per day, while 1.3 billion get by on less than $1 per day. And you know, granted, people are having maybe different cost of living or different expectations, and it's not that any of that is really good news for anyone. But I think it, you know, we sometimes can lose a little bit of a sense of, you know, what, how fortunate am I, and what do I have? So on the one hand, I want to suggest that it's possible that we have more than we sometimes feel like we have because we're comparing ourselves to a very skewed piece of the world population. And yet, at the same time, I also want to, you know, kind of wipe that out a little bit, actually. And you know, think about the fact that doing any of these kinds of comparisons actually it actually reinforces a sense of separateness. You know, maybe you're thinking silently in your head, oh, you know, I wonder where I rank on this list, and I wonder where other people rank on this list, and it keeps everyone feeling separate. You know, it doesn't feel, you know, when we feel like we have more than other people, that is often not a comfortable feeling. And when we feel that we have less than other people, that is also not a very comfortable feeling. It leads to a lot of, you know, anxiety and discomfort and just a feeling that we are not a part of others. So wanted to talk about another story that I read about recently, and maybe some of you have heard this in the news. This was in the news a couple weeks ago. There was a man in upstate New York, in Syracuse, who won $5 million in the New York Mega Millions lottery. But he won that money in 2007, and he waited until March 1st of 2012 to claim what he won. He waited almost 5 years. It was 11 days before this was going to expire. I guess you have 5 years to claim your prize. And he waited until then because, and they, you know, they interviewed him. He said he was concerned that this windfall could negatively influence his life. And, you know, you can think about how might $5 million negatively impact someone's life. And I think, you know, I think I had this sort of reaction of like, okay, so why was he buying a Mega Millions ticket if he's, you know, worried that this is going to negatively influence his life? But I think we can't know, you know, we think, oh, sure, you know, I wouldn't mind having that problem. But I don't know that we can really know that, you know, until it happens to you. So, you know, what he was afraid of is he was afraid that he was involved with a woman who he was thinking about asking to marry him. He was thinking about getting engaged, and he was afraid that this news might impact his engagement and marriage, and in such a way that he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't necessarily know why this person might be agreeing to marry him. And so he waited until that had, you know, kind of played itself out. She was now his wife. I'm sure she was completely surprised. He was also afraid that it could alienate his family members. And he spent quite a lot of time apparently thinking about who he wanted to help in his family and how he would help them and what he might do, how he might, you know, find a way to reflectively respond to what he imagined would be requests from family members and friends. And, you know, finally, he was afraid that he would manage the money poorly, that, you know, I think many, many people who are in this circumstance wind off, you know, 3 years later just exactly where they were before because they don't really know how to manage $5 million. And so he felt that he needed time to learn, you know, some good financial planning and to really sort of prepare himself for this change. And I think this is a remarkable story, not because of the $5 million, but I think this story kind of illustrates one aspect of what I want to think about when, you know, we're thinking about generosity and giving, and which is, I think this man was able to view his life not just as his life, but to view it in context with others in his world and consider how he could act judiciously. And so that's, I think, you know, kind of the main point of what I want to get into today is, I think it's a question, you know, that maybe we can think about as we think about how do we want to bring our, you know, our awareness of interdependence that we maybe gain through Zazen into our life, and how do we, you know, how do we make beneficial decisions about what to do with the resources that come into our lives? And I do not have any answers for anybody in this talk about this. I think this is a question that each person has to answer for him or herself. But I want to introduce the idea of just sort of a metaphor of a river, you know, that's maybe we're all in the river and the river is sort of flowing around us and it's maybe flowing through us, and our own individual actions determine to some extent where that river is going to flow. And we have, the river is maybe just the river of all the different resources that are coming into our lives, maybe because of our own hard work or maybe because of our own good luck. But it might include money, for sure, you know, time, skills, care, and attention. And, you know, in that flow, you know, we talk about self and others, but others includes ourself. You know, we're one of the others. We're one of the many beings who needs some of those resources, needs to use some of the resources that are coming in. And, you know, I think, you know, we often maybe need to use the vast majority of those resources that are coming into our lives, but we don't need them all. You know, and I want to sort of suggest that maybe there is a way that we could see these resources that and this flow that maybe helps us to just be a little bit less personally attached to them, you know, and see them maybe more as a common good that we share. You know, our life itself is something that is really, you know, on kind of temporary loan to us, and the things that are coming into our lives are things that are temporary, and they're, you know, and they're coming through our lives as well, you know, and so I want to think about, you know, is there a way that we can use our resources to benefit self and others? And this is maybe less important how much we have than what kind of attitude or spirit that we bring to this. So I think, you know, in thinking about this, I think it, you know, it calls into our awareness maybe also other paramitas and precepts, and I'll talk about those in a moment, but it also, you know, it requires a sort of a sense of, you know, what do I want my life to be about, and what are things that I think might be important to foster in the world, and how can I do that? Whether it's, you know, I think some of us have more money than time, some of us have more time than money, some of us just have the ability to care, you know, and to pay attention and to listen, and maybe, you know, have the skill to influence others. And so there are all kinds of ways that we can bring all of what we have to helping to create some of the things that you know, might be beneficial to the world. I think it was, you know, Gandhi who said, be the change you wish to see in the world. And I think this kind of applies to this concept. Some other paramitas that I think might be involved, you know, I think Teigen talks about all of the paramitas as really developing together and, you know, starting and ending with generosity. But others would include maybe Shila paramita, which is ethical conduct and thinking about how might we want to use the resources in our life in an ethical way, or to support ethical principles in our world. I think it also includes virya paramita, or effort. What kind of, you know, energy do we have? What can we do with the energy that comes to us? How might we be able to, you know, marshal our energy and resources to make some of these things happen? It certainly involves prajna, or wisdom, in spending, you know, some time reflecting on what might be the, you know, what might be the fruit of any particular action that we're taking, and what might be the result. Upaya, or skillful means, is another one of my favorites. I think a lot of what we do in the world is just trying to find a way to develop skillful means. But I think there's a way to develop skillful means and study skillful means with giving. Like with this gentleman who won the lottery, I think he had to think very hard about what might be the effect of, you know, giving one of my family members $1 million. Might that impact them in good ways as well as negative ways? And how might I then be able to, you know, help that person or do something skillful? It also involves bala, or powers. Giving can connote some power. Receiving can connote a sense of powerlessness, and I think it's something to pay attention to. And finally, I think jnana, or knowledge paramita, which is different from prajna or wisdom. Jnana is, I think it connotes a sense of the very practical details of life and how do we do things. And it's maybe this gentleman who won the lottery, he wanted to know, how do I manage money? How do I find a financial planner? All those sort of little, you know, nuts and bolts kind of elements of how we do something with what we have. So there are lots of paramitas involved. I think there's also a number of precepts, and the precepts are, you know, we have 16 bodhisattva precepts that we talk about and think about and try to practice within our lineage. And some of the ones that are, I think, especially relevant to this topic are embracing and sustaining all good and embracing and sustaining all beings. Can we use our resources in such a way that we sustain, you know, something that's good? Not killing, not stealing, which is also known as not taking what is not given. Not intoxicating mind and body of self or others, not harboring ill will. Can we sometimes anger or harboring ill will kind of creates a stop in that flow of things coming to us and leaving us. Not praising self at the expense of others, so not, you know, giving in such a way that makes us feel superior or inferior. Or make others feel inferior, and not being possessive of anything. So, you know, there's recognizing what we legitimately need in our lives, and then there's recognizing what we might be able to offer to our environment. So, you know, I guess that I'm not intending to talk about this in such a way. You know, I think we can think about a way that we practice these things where we're thinking, you know, all the time, like, am I doing the right thing? Is this okay? You know, what if I do this or what if I do this? What I'm actually suggesting is that in generosity and in practicing generosity, there's a way in which we don't get rid of ourselves, you know? We don't just say, okay, well, I'll just give everything and then, you know, as if we didn't need some of that. You know, we do. But what I'm suggesting is really if there's a way that we can maybe practice this that helps us let go just slightly, or just, you know, maybe not everything all at once, but just let go a little bit more than we have, to let some resources sort of flow through our lives in a beneficial way. So having said that, I'm not sure how much time. We've got about 15 minutes for discussion. If anybody has anything that they would like to share or questions about generosity or anything that I've talked about, or if anybody just has more general questions. I know that there were a number of people who came for the first time, and if there are questions about, you know, anything that has taken place today that, you know, maybe any of us could answer, I'd be happy to do that. So. Kathy.
Thank you for that talk. It was interesting. An article that I read in Time magazine about a month ago was interesting. It said that it mentioned five important issues, or anyway, it was talking about some things that have shifted in the world in the last year or so. And during the Japanese tsunami, something shifted in terms of who and how much was given. Much more was given, but more importantly, it was given from a much broader group of people. So even people who don't have much money, who are in what we would call third world countries, were giving what they could afford, and it was through the text messaging. And so the comment was that there's a sense of wanting to be part of this by everybody, and that even if people who have a very small amount to give it, and everyone does, along with people who have more, the volume of the gift is bigger. But I thought it was especially interesting because I think there's a desire there to be part of giving, even if you don't have very much.
Mm. I love that. Did they happen to say why that shift has taken place? Did they see it as sort of an overall shift in something?
Due to the technology of cell phones now being in third world countries and people being able to text, so it was easy to text in a gift, you know, so that number that, you know, is on TV and everywhere, you know, you could easily text, like I think here on TV it was, you can text $10 with this. You know, you just need to call in this number.
Yeah.
Well, evidently, people did that around the world. And even if it was a few dollars, it was coming from a much broader.
So I guess it sounds like there's a couple things at play. One is our growing sense of awareness of what's happening in other parts of the world, of the world, and a you know, sense of connection with people who are experiencing those events, but also a sense that there is something that I can do right now to help.
And the technology is kind of connecting us. But yeah, I think it's tapping into maybe that sense of wanting to be part of it has always been there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's that sense of caring that, you know, when we hear someone else's cries, you know, we have a reaction, but we don't always feel like there's anything we can do. Thanks. I think that is one of the names of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is the hearer of the cries of the world. And I've always loved that image, that just when we're, you know, when you're in pain, there's that sense of, I wish somebody were listening. That's the image I get of Kanzeon or Kanon. But it sounds like that's a little bit of what is, you know, maybe motivating people too, is they hear these things and they want to do something. Mm-hmm. Anybody have anything?
Yeah. I was looking on Google last night, actually, coincidentally with this conversation about trying to give after Sandy. I'm here with my sister. I am from, we're from Arlington, but she lives in Chicago, so I'm just visiting. The D.C. area wasn't hit very hard where we're from.
Yeah.
But the whole East Coast is totally rocked. I was just looking at, like, ways to give or to donate or to volunteer, and there's already so many people. I've read a couple of articles about people like going into Manhattan and going into parts affected in New York and giving like out pies and pizzas and water bottles and people giving out, like trying to raise money to get generators in for people, and just lots of congregations like giving people warm places to stay at night, and lots of people giving out clothing, and it's just really remarkable. It kind of goes with what you guys were just talking about.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that and talking about it, you know, from more of a closer perspective, because I know that's been sort of the big concern this week is all the people who have maybe lost lives or lost their homes or lost power or lost something, and how to help with such a devastating loss. But it is really hopeful to hear about, you know, specific things that are being done to help with that. Anybody else have any question or comment or anything about anything today? Jeremy.
Thank you for the talk. Something I've been reading about, somebody I've been reading about, is Vimalakirti. It's a story about Bodhisattva who is extremely rich. And I know in the Metta Sutta we chant that one not take upon the burden of riches, but Vimalakirti kind of stands that on its head and has all this wealth, and he uses his wealth to further the Dharma and take care of people, and, you know, finds ways to be present with all things and give in a respectful manner.
Yeah. Really cool. He's a great Buddhist example of that. You know, along with that, I was thinking about how last week we were talking about Sagaki Day and talking about the hungry ghosts in the world, which we all of us sometimes can be. You know, they're the beings who are depicted as having huge bellies that constantly need to be filled, but tiny necks, so they can't really swallow anything. And you know, it's funny to move so quickly from, you know, a spirit of a feeling of not having enough and how that feels in our lives to a feeling of having something and being able to share it. And he was an excellent example. Thanks for bringing that up. Anything else? Yeah, Douglas.
Well, I wanted to express my appreciation for what Vivian said about how that unselfish giving is an expression of awakened mind. And I think many of us who come to Zen centers or temples sort of have an expectation that, awakened mind is something you discover in an esoteric practice like Zazen or ceremonies and reading sutras or having great profound intellectual insights. And so, but I think that it is important to remember that just unselfish giving is that ordinary experience is it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the expression of awakened mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's something you can't calculate, obviously. I mean, it's not a what's in it for me. It's not like, I'll give money so they'll put my name on a building. And
yeah.
You can't give and say, well, I'm getting great karma. Look what a great person I am. It's really,
mm-hmm.
It is that experience of unselfishly wanting to help someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that all of us have experienced.
Yeah, and just caring. I think some of the most humbling moments for me in my life are times when I see others who seem that, for one reason or another, to not have as much, to be able to give something in a situation where I'm feeling like I've got nothing to give, and we all have those times, for one reason or another, where we're stressed or we're in, some kind of circumstance where we just feel like we don't have anything to give. And there are lots of different reminders, and I think that's, I was hoping to just bring some of them, to light about things that can remind us, to just let go of that. It's not a weighing the cost and balances. It's just like a loosening of our grasp a little bit. it doesn't have to require so much thought as it does just, relaxing maybe. But yet I am so aware in my own life of how hard that is to do sometimes and how humbling it can be when to do it or to not.
A very good friend and I recently inherited quite a bit of money. And I've noticed now when I spend time with her, I feel poor and I feel needy. And it occurs to me, I'm not any richer or poorer than I was before, but there is something about, that comparison thing of when you put yourself next to somebody else, all of a sudden you feel like you lack, or sometimes you feel like you have excess, but you have what you have. It's not relevant to what other people have or don't have, and that ability to give stays the same. It's just where you are and which angle you're looking
from. Yeah, yeah. And there's no, we're not getting brownie points anywhere for giving or not giving. But comparison, I think, can always lead to a sense of discomfort or definitely a sense of separateness. Somebody else is out there and they're different. And, whether we come up good on that comparison or come up in sort of the negative numbers on that comparison, it just never feels good. It's one of those, relative things that maybe distracts from more of the sense of, okay, so how can I do something here? How can I contribute to the whole?
But there's also a sense that it reflects back on what you think of your own situation, somehow, your situation may not have changed at all, but that you're seeing it in a way that's...
Yeah, yeah. Well, like the global rich, it's like, whoa, I didn't realize.
Right, yeah.
Not that it makes any, personal difference in your life. It's more just a sense of awareness.
Yeah.